After your father's murder, you were orphaned. You were 10 years old. You went to live with cousins on a sheep and horse ranch in Montana. And?
And one morning, I just ran away.
Not just, Clarice. What set you off? You started at what time?
Early, still dark.
Then something woke you, didn't it? Was it a dream? What was it?
I heard a strange noise.
What was it?
It was screaming. Some kind of screaming, like a child's voice.
What did you do?
I went downstairs, outside. I crept up into the barn. I was so scared to look inside, but I had to.
What did you see, Clarice? What did you see?
Lambs. They were screaming.
Hello, welcome to the Extra Credits Plus of Fava Beans, Chianti, and the Silence of the Lambs. I'm Trey.
And I'm Kelsey.
So before we get into this masterpiece, and Jonathan Demme, Clarice Starling, James Gum as Buffalo Bill,
fly.
And Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter, and also controversy surrounding identity in this movie, I want to ask an important question. Is Chianti even good? I've never knowingly had it, and I think that's kind of surprising because we're a big red wine house, and I love Cab Sauv, Merlot, Say Less, I'm there if it's there. But does Hannibal Lecter have bad taste in wine?
I doubt it.
That is my first question of today's podcast.
Also, another question, what are fava beans? I think they're like a lima bean. I looked it up, but...
Okay. I have some
just
interesting.
Want to trust that Hannibal Lecter has better taste in food and wine than us because
I think you're right.
He seems like he has a lot of money.
Yes. Plus, I think it's confirmed in Ridley Scott's Hannibal that he does drink good red wine.
Okay.
Based on that reaction from
yeah.
the musical
well,
crowd.
It feels like he can afford like the best of ingredients, you know,
to, Silence the Lambs.
To just mix up.
Secretly about classism. We'll get into it. So The Silence of the Lambs is one of my favorite films of all time. It is one
Same.
Of those movies that teaches you everything you need to know about filmmaking and also has really strong feelings about themes that are important to us in film, about gender dynamics, misogyny, morality, mortality. And it has some other semi-developed ideas about otherness, and we'll get into all of that. But this is a... super powerful human character study. And I am speaking about this movie as if it's a Kelly Reichardt film right now, but I swear, I know it's a genre popcorn blockbuster thriller, but this film just means a lot to me. The director, Jonathan Demme, is one of the best American filmmakers of the 80s and 90s. He brings an emotional intelligence to what would be a genre, you know, just normal popcorn movie in 1991 featuring FBI propaganda and serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
And instead he elevates expectations in really massive ways. And honestly, he makes horrors and thrillers acceptable for all audiences. I think it's the first horror movie, honestly, that's won Best Picture.
Yeah.
Which
well,
is wild.
That's something I want to talk about today because this is a thriller movie to me with horror elements.
Okay, I was going to ask you that because I'm biased. Like, I have been watching this since my preteen years. Like I said, I've in the past, I've watched Seven Too Young, The Usual Suspects,
yeah.
Silence of the Lambs. And 1991 is a great year, too. I watched Boys in the Hood a lot from, you know, this era of film. My
right,
parents
which was also
like,
nominated for an Oscar this year.
Yes, I actually wish that would have won. Maybe that's a later conversation we can have. But yeah, I was going to ask you, like, are you still transported into this movie? Because you also said it's one of your favorites because of the tension, because of the thrills, because of the horror. Because I was thinking that you would be more into the psychological, like mental gymnastics of this movie on rewatch. Is that how you feel? You come back to this like fast paced thriller for the conversations, basically?
Yeah. When we were rewatching this for the podcast, I looked over to Trey and I said, it's interesting that I'm not afraid of this movie at all anymore. And I think, yeah. you know, the first time I watched it, I hadn't really gotten into horror as much, even though I completely understand why people do consider this a horror movie, even though I think it falls more in thriller
mm-hmm.
with those horror elements that we'll talk more about today. But I enjoy the thrill aspect of it that we kind of get towards the end, especially with Jodie Foster being alone and doing something that I, you know, I'm like, why doesn't she call for backup?
Sure. But, yeah. It's really good at asking, but getting the audience so to ask much those sense. Questions.
Everything makes so much sense within the through line of her character.
Yes.
And I think that's why I come back to this movie is Clarice Starling as a character and her relationship with Hannibal Lecter. I think it's so fascinating. And the relationship that they have, kind of like the mentorship that they have, mm-hmm. how they're talking about people in order to get to know them to solve the case versus just like solving this cold case or looking at like forensic elements that we see in popular TV shows that are also very fun. But I come back for the character study. I come back for Clarice Starling. And I also think she's like a very singular character in American filmography that I remember when I first saw it, I was like, I've never seen a character like her, right?
Yeah.
She has like strengths, not in being like a masculine hero that we think of maybe in like a Marvel movie, right? Like there's a substitute. Yeah. There's a woman, but she's like specifically like within a masculine archetype that we see in stories in American iconography. But Clarice Starling like is using her strengths and looking at details that other people are not able to because of her socialization.
She's one of the most observational characters in film history. I mean, as a kid, I remember this being like a very inspirational like work figure for me. I was like, I don't know if I want to be in this job, but I definitely want to operate this way in my job in the future if I can help people. I remember thinking that a lot as a teenager. I was like, I love Ellen Ripley from Alien. I love Jane Craig from Broadcast News. And I love Clarice Starling from The Silence of the Lambs. What is like a through line of those characters? I'd love to talk about that with you today to psychologize myself a bit. Because those three characters, and probably Hermione Granger, were all very, very important to me as a kid. And obviously, like I had, you know, some other like masculine figures I'm sure I looked up to, but those four were huge for me. And so, yeah, I agree, totally co-sign everything you said about Clarice. We'll get into her today. I'm really excited to also talk about the late great Jonathan Demme, because this is somebody we've never talked about on the podcast before. But like I said a second ago, he's just one of the most sensitive and raw genre filmmakers that went from journeyman director to household name auteur. And I think that probably starts with his style that is so iconic from this film, especially with his, you know, working cinematographer, Tak Fujimoto, the POV shots, the subjective experiences, the incredible Demme close-ups, the humane treatment of the wide range of characters, from periphery characters in the background to supporting leads behind the lead characters to the lead characters in the intersection of those lead characters. He also has like some of the greatest needle drops in film. I think Scorsese's name is talked about a lot, and it should be when it comes to needle drops. But Jonathan Demme also has some phenomenal ones.
Yeah.
And I think for any aspiring filmmakers who listen to the show, you know, you probably already know this, but just I'll say it to all of our normal listeners, like aspiring filmmakers can learn so much from studying Demme's filmography, his career, his journey, but specifically with The Silence of the Lambs. I think this is just like such a masterclass of filmmaking.
Yes. Yeah.
And then thematically in Demme's career, he has always been fascinated by gender dynamics. He always has like woman leads trying to navigate their workplaces and the world at large. He's interested in this kind of like mental chess game of his characters trying to explore a world that might not want them there, which is, you know, really manifested in this movie.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that today.
Yeah, especially with all the cops and Clarice, and we'll get into that. He's really interested also in like how tension intersects between comedy and horror. Like, I don't think there is a Jordan Peele or an Ari Aster or, you know, just recently with Zach Cregger without this filmmaker.
Somebody great take,
who made like screwball comedies and then also made probably the most important horror film of all time, I would argue, because it wins Best Picture. It opens up the door to horror to wider audiences of different classes, I think. And yeah, he's just incredibly important. And I think he also has like one of the greatest skills of any filmmaker, which is to emphasize tension through visual language instead of just dialogue. He's one of the most interesting visual filmmakers too. So I'm excited to get into him as just like this very special artist. I think any filmmaker who's able to be this emotionally intelligent at a high level, who deeply wants you to understand their characters, such as like someone like Hannibal Lecter, shows you how incredibly talented he is, because it is wild how he makes Hannibal Lecter, Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter, a human being in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, I think his empathy is really setting him apart at this time in 1991 from his 80s filmmakers.
Yeah. And I think that's why this is one of the most interesting horror movies, in that it makes its villain a full person.
Yes.
Right. And he, if you listen to Jonathan Demme, he will talk about how even in specific scenes, they do a lot of different takes with people looking in different directions, mm-hmm. or like even very small things, right? The tone of someone's voice. And we'll talk about that also in the way he shoots it with the close up and point of view shots and
yes. like
tracking shots in the basement. And so I think
the dollies and yeah. James Gunn's house at the end.
Right. Yeah. And so I think like his close attention to how he positions his characters in a scene, mm-hmm. and then also how he lets the audience, like he treats the audience like they're smart, right?
Yes,
like he
yeah,
allows he them to have them. Space between what is actually going on in the reality of the movie, to have questions, to interpret, but also to like very straightforward give information about his character, specifically Buffalo Bill, that we'll talk about,
mm-hmm.
Is it James Gunn?
Yeah, James Gunn.
Okay. Yeah, it's a tough name to say.
Yeah.
But so that's what I'm really excited to talk about also.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much when it comes to his filmmaking, from sound design to costumes and makeup to blocking. It's really, again, just like a masterclass of filmmaking and some of the best pacing of any studio film
yes, yeah.
I have ever seen. This is under 2 hours, and I just respect, I admire thrillers, horrors that are masterpieces that can really hold your attention for 2 hours. That's really impressive to me. It's wild. I'm just like looking back at the year of film right now, like I was looking at Boys in the Hood on my list. It is wild, the movies that came out between 1990 and 1991 that were so iconic for pacing and atmosphere. We weren't born yet, but people watched Goodfellas in the fall of 1990. And then by February, they watched Silence of the Lambs.
Wow.
By spring, they're watching Thelma and Louise, Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
And then by the summer, they're watching James Cameron's Terminator 2. And then Boys in the Hood to end 1991. What a time to be alive. So shout out anybody who was alive in theaters
wild.
At that time, because that's incredible.
I feel like people will be talking about the year 2017 that way.
Oh, we're going to be talking about that very soon. I think we'll have a 2017-ish movie on the pod very soon. And then the acting of Lambs, before we begin, just like shout out really quickly, Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster have never been better in a movie than in this film. Their like psychological interrogation of each other is anxiety inducing.
Oh my God, yeah.
It is an incredible showcase of just two actors having complete confidence in each other. Like Hopkins wouldn't be able to be as shocking and methodical as Hannibal if it wasn't for Jodie Foster's intimidating kind of nonverbal performance, mm-hmm. I think is the best way to put it, because I would love to, I read some of the script today and I meant to kind of like try to, I was going to word count it, but I was going to like highlight in word count because I was curious about how many more words that Hannibal Lecter has than Jodie Foster, because he's in about 30-ish minutes of the movie. He's off camera a lot for those 30-ish minutes, but I'm pretty sure he talks like twice as much as Jodie Foster does in this film, which is fascinating.
Wow. Yeah, so I would love to track that. I mean, but it's part of his character is that his presence kind of looms so large over the movie.
It's great, isn't
and
it?
And his performance, like you're saying, and his chemistry with Jodie Foster, like has so much to do with that.
Yeah, and there's like most of their scenes, there's like glass between them. You know what I mean? That's pretty wild that it's so memorable. So yeah, I mean, this is just, The Silence of the Lambs is a movie that makes you want to make movies. Like there aren't many of those. You know what I mean? Like this movie inspires people to become filmmakers, and that's such a cool thing to say. And I'm sure Jonathan Demme really loved people's reaction to it in that way, for just like pushing the art form forward. So we'll get more into him today, his vision, his complicated legacy when it comes to this movie as well. Just so all of our listeners know, as always, we're going to dive into what works and what sometimes doesn't work in this movie and might be underdeveloped too. So as always, our Extra Credits Plus episodes are deep dives, but they are also live commentary. So we will be discussing The Silence of the Lambs while watching it. And if you're on the main feed, that means you're listening to the first 30 minutes of this episode. So you can go into our description and you'll find the Patreon, the Extra Credits Plus, where you can find us on Living Plus. That's where our members get access to the full 2 to 3 hour deep dives we publish on there, as well as the 3 episodes we cover each new month. It looks like we already have our February episodes ready to go. So we're going to have those on a Patreon exclusive newsletter very soon.
Exciting.
Very exciting. For any listeners who want to listen and watch along, you can stream The Silence of the Lambs right now on Max. You can rent it for like $3 or $4, or for the real lamb heads out there. For $20, you can own the Blu-ray trilogy of Manhunter, Silence of the Lambs, and Hannibal, which I recommend because Manhunter rules. And Ridley Scott's Hannibal has problems, but it's good. And we also own, we own that trilogy, but we also own the Criterion edition of Silence of the Lambs. So if you're willing to cough up like $35, I recommend that too. It's got literally hours of special features, which is great for any super fan.
Yeah. You know what? Speaking of Living Plus today, I love that Brian Cox is Hannibal in
one of our movies
in the Hannibal Lecter universe. When I cannot wait to talk about Michael Mann's Manhunter today.
Yeah, we're going to probably start off the movie talking about Manhunter a little bit. All right, ready?
Yeah.
Okay, on play, we're going to start the movie. 3, 2, 1, play. All right, so pre-production. Let's talk a little bit about the making of this movie. If people don't know, writer Thomas Harris wrote a crime trilogy of Red Dragon, The Silence of the Lambs, and Hannibal within like 10 to 15 years. And I guess that gives us the informal film trilogy directed by what we were just talking about, Michael Mann, Jonathan Demme, and Ridley Scott. I don't think we need to get too deeply into Scott's Hannibal because, like I said, it does have problems. But I think we should start off today's episode talking about Michael Mann's Manhunter.
Yes, okay.
Because that movie, I don't think Silence of the Lambs like exists without how great Manhunter is.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I agree. When I hear people talk about Manhunter, I honestly think they haven't seen it in like 15 years. Because when you rewatch this thing, it moves. And it has that kind of like, I mean, it struggled critically and commercially when it came out, but it has become a cult classic, and not by accident over the past like 40 years. Because I think it is that maybe the best Michael Mann psychological prison movie that he's ever made. And I know a lot of people love Heat. I love Heat. A lot of people love Thief. Thief rules. But Manhunter, I think, blends the Michael Mann experience best, that dramatic, atmospheric interest that he is so fascinated by. And I think every moment of that movie that would usually be kind of like genre schlock or propaganda is actually like a very, very smart, transgressive exploration of law and crime as a paradox, and how cops are tasked to hunt down the very people their power or unmitigated power creates. And it's sort of just like a near perfect thriller with phenomenal performances. And I just don't think, because of the success of Silence of the Lambs, I think people underrate Manhunter. But it honestly, it could be 5 stars.
I think it is. Yeah. I think it's just as good as Silence of the Lambs.
Wow.
And I think it has a lot to do with similar pacing, actually, as Silence of the Lambs. So I feel like if you like this movie, haven't seen Manhunter in a while and want to revisit it, or haven't seen Manhunter at all, that's amazing. Because I think you'll really enjoy the kind of same propulsion that the story has. And also, I think that it does something similar to Silence of the Lambs, in that it's really interested in its, you know, quote unquote villain the serial killer in the movie. And the whole objective is to try to understand what is making this person tick, right? Like, why are they doing what they're doing? And I think actually that storyline, even though I think Silence of the Lambs is a little bit better, even though they're both 5 stars to me, I do think that storyline, and in terms of the serial killer himself, he is actually maybe a more interesting character than Silence of the Lambs.
We get more context with his character than we do with Ted Levine's James Gunn in this film.
That's true.
As Buffalo Bill, which is fascinating because I feel like every other aspect of Silence of the Lambs is like a half star step up. Because I'm more on the 4.5-star Manhunter. I love the take that it's just as good as Silence of the Lambs. I'm excited to rewatch it now that you said that. I think it's a good take. Like, William Peterson as Will Graham is, first off, like, it's really hard to do sexy psycho, and he does that really well. Like, there's an argument to be made that Will Graham is the craziest person in Manhunter when he's like, you know, debating serial killers, you know, like Hannibal Lecter and Francis Dolarhyde. It is quite the movie. So we just got the introduction to Clarice Starling running through the misty forest of the FBI.
Great opening.
Kind of a nightmarish opening.
Yeah, great font too. It's that black font surrounded by like the white highlight.
Yeah, I love when opening title card sequences and the opening credits aren't afraid to just cover the whole screen, because it makes you try to like see what's behind the letters.
That's true, yeah.
And you're really trying to like, you know, pay attention to the detail. We're getting the iconic shot of Clarice in the elevator, all the men surrounding her, almost like a pack of wolves. And we'll definitely talk about that today. First, though, I want to get into more pre-production for Silence of the Lambs. So Gene Hackman originally teamed up with Orion Pictures in the 80s, bought the rights to Silence of the Lambs.
Right.
And then Hackman shot Mississippi Burning, which is another FBI film, which is a more complicated legacy, I think, in many ways than this movie. And as his fame grew, he thought the Lambs script was a little bit too violent. The report is that like his daughter was like, "Hey, Dad, don't do this movie. It's going to ruin your career." That seems like he was just using his daughter as a justification because he wanted to sell this movie. I'm not sure why. And so he sold the rights back fully to Orion. But it's an interesting what if, because I think Hackman was planning on directing and starring as Jack Crawford, who was the head of the behavioral science unit at the FBI in Silence of the Lambs.
Right.
Unfortunately, though, even though I think Gene Hackman is obviously a very talented actor, I think he'd make the movie more about him, and he'd probably play the role in like a really dour way, like, you know, his character in The French Connection or The Conversation.
Yeah, I think his presence is too big for the Jack Crawford role. Yeah. I think that Jack Crawford, we need to be skeptical of his intentions of sending Clarice.
And agreed.
I think in this movie, you know, it's not necessarily that he becomes this like amazing figure in Clarice's life, even though he does serve as a mentor. Mm-hmm. But we need this sort of like, what is he about? And like, we know that he's manipulating her, right?
Yes.
And Gene Hackman just brings too big of a personality to that role for me.
No, totally. I agree. I think that's the right take. Plus, I really like Scott Glenn as Jack Crawford. I think he does
great.
A good job in terms of like balancing the manipulative behavioral sciences unit director while also being sort of his like self-awareness. The thing I love about this movie too, all the characters are so self-aware and so is the filmmaking, but his character like kind of understands that he is playing this father figure of sorts. Mm-hmm. Whereas the novel really plays mm-hmm. into this like psychosexual, if not directly sexual relationship between Clarice and Jack Crawford and between Clarice and Hannibal Lecter, which is a lot more problematic to me, honestly. That's a lot weirder. In terms of how this movie got to Jonathan Demme, Orion Pictures got the rights. Ted Talley was writing the screenplay, who had already written a few screenplays, but he was more in theater at the time. Jonathan Demme knew him well, and this is actually the only movie Jonathan Demme had ever signed up for without reading a screenplay first.
I was just going to say that because
it was a wild choice.
When I heard him say that on the director's commentary, I thought that was wild.
Yeah.
I don't think that's normal. He said it wasn't, but he basically just said he had so much faith in the screenwriter to write a really nuanced story that he signed on.
Yes. I thought it was interesting on a few fronts that Orion wanted Demme specifically. And so much so that that was like the first director they went to when Hackman left the project, apparently. Because he wasn't like this famous auteur filmmaker then. People might say that, but he was like a journeyman filmmaker at this time. And this movie completely changed the trajectory of his career, as well as all of these actors as well. Even though, you know, we'll talk about Jodie Foster is coming off an Oscar, her career really takes off after this movie. And Anthony Hopkins also wasn't exactly having that Hall of Fame career that we, you know, think of him to have today until really this film. So it's interesting because like Demme started his career off with exploitation films produced by Roger Corman, not unlike many of the filmmakers that we've discussed on the show. Recently, we talked about Scorsese's career on our Goodfellas episode and how Roger Corman really helped him find his direction off of Boxcar Bertha. So I think that lane was never Jonathan Demme's lane, but it was interesting what happened after his exploitation films. He started finding himself inspired to make more serious work, and he was kind of inspired by the politics of the 80s, and he started making more serious works about social justice going into the 90s from narratives that are like famous films and Oscar-winning films like Philadelphia on the AIDS crisis, which we'll probably talk a little bit about today as a kind of a semi-response to the criticism and the backlash to Silence of the Lambs, and to essential documentaries that Demme made like Haiti, Dreams of Democracy, to then propelling concert films like I just watched for the first time the other night, Stop Making Sense, which I know people have been talking about that movie a lot since its re-release in theaters from A24, concert film that covers the Talking Heads. And that was so bizarre. That was like a cocaine-induced aerobics, incredible bizarre set design, with in just such insightful filmmaking, because they never pan to the audience. They always stay on this like this like thematic journey.
It's the movie, hypnotic.
Yeah, it's hypnotic because it starts off with the artist coming on stage after each new song, slowly but surely, and then the movie kind of turns into this polemic. It has a lot of themes in it, and it's fascinating. I can't wait to rewatch it. And then, you know, obviously Jonathan Demme, also known for making screwball classics like Something Wild in 86, and then hardcore melodramas in the 2000s, like Rachel Getting Married. I think Rachel Getting Married is probably like a top three Jonathan Demme for me personally. It's got some great Anne Hathaway in it. And he's just made a lot of movies that do a great job at provoking discussions about gender and race and power. And his films are still welcoming. Sometimes when you have movies with such strong social commentaries, they can feel a little bit distancing or sometimes even like a little bit pretentious. And his movies don't feel that way. And so I think with The Silence of the Lambs, it's his most important and engrossing work because the United States is at a really odd political moment transitioning from the Reagan era into the Bush era. So you can kind of feel the anxiety in this movie of the political moment. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah. And I think if you look at a movie like Rachel Getting Married and then you look at Silence of the Lambs, it is interesting that the same filmmaker, you know, made both these movies with such different vibes. But I think the like character focus that he brings to the thriller is why this is one of the, again, like most interesting and popular thrillers of all time, because of that kind of humanity that he's able to bring to the story.
Yeah, there's just an empathy there. I know it's overused with Jonathan Demme, but it really is. There's an empathetic, like human approach to his filmmaking that makes you care about the worst of people. You want to know more about them. It's not a forgiving style. It's more of a kind of sociological approach to the filmmaking where he deeply wants to understand the environment of the characters, what they've been through. And he's also been very good at suggestion through visuals and not always through dialogue. As for casting in the Lambs film, Clarice Starling and Hannibal Lecter were very challenging roles, apparently, to cast, considering the subject matter. One of my faves of all time, Michelle Pfeiffer, worked with Demme in his career on Married to the Mob and was offered Clarice Starling.
Yeah.
But she said Lambs was too dark of a screenplay. And I love Jodie Foster in this. I love her career choices. She's a fascinating actor to talk about. She deserves her own 2-hour episode, honestly. Michelle Pfeiffer in this movie?
You would have preferred Michelle Pfeiffer?
1991, too? I think so. I think that's the only actor, if you were like, because normally if you said, I would say it's sacrilegious to recast Silence of the Lambs, you know what I mean? But if I was like one actor, like Sigourney Weaver from 1982, around that time, like Michelle Pfeiffer, 1990, like I would only give a few options, you know what I mean? And I think it's a great one. Also, Meg Ryan was offered the role, but she also considered the role too disturbing, which is interesting.
I couldn't see Meg Ryan in here. It's similar to how Julianne Moore plays Clarice in the Hannibal movie that Ridley Scott directs later on. There's something too... I don't know. Like, you kind of like...
She brings like a mannequin effect, though, to that role. Like, that's a really tough Julianne Moore performance. Yeah.
Yeah. There's something that is like off in their performance that doesn't make me believe that they have this like kind of performative toughness that they're having to put on because of the world that they're operating in. It almost feels like you know, and it's not maybe to a detriment. It's a strength in certain roles, but I feel like Julianne Moore and Meg Ryan have a kind of like clear cut, like gentle nature about them that is charming.
Yeah.
But it is not something like a Jodie Foster, who I believe so much as Clarice Starling.
So to counter my own argument and going with what you just said about Jodie Foster, what does make her special is she is the perfect wallflower actor, you know? And that's what this character really needs, is somebody who is observational in a corner. You never notice we're there, but they're also the smartest person in the room. And that is what this character demands. And she does that so well. So thankfully, we get Jodie Foster. Laura Dern apparently was offered the role too, and she was in and good to go. But the studio was we need a bigger name. We want to make
someone. You know who he is, don't you? Tell me who decapitated your patient, doctor.
All good things to those who wait. I've waited, Clarice, but how long can you and old Jackie boy wait? Our little Billy must already be searching for that next special lady.
Hi.
Hello there. Sorry for interrupting.
Yeah. Thank you for listening so far. And hopefully you are enjoying the episode so far. I feel like maybe if you made it this far.
They got it this far. They're having a good time.
I mean, let's hope. But to access our full conversation, you can go to the description of this episode to join our Patreon community, the Extra Credits Plus.
Yes. And for only $5 a month, you can get access to our full catalog of Patreon exclusive episodes. Hope to see you there. Take it easy, baby.